And this time I thought we'd be on the big one, jhanas. So sit down comfortably. I'm going to take you on a journey into the outer stratosphere of the mind, or rather the inner stratosphere, for the wonderful states of bliss and what they are and how to get them. What happens if you don't get them? This is on the talk from the jhanas. Did I clear that? And their place in the matter of things. Probably it's best I could talk about sort of how they're achieved first of all, and then what they are, and then what their significance is. Because you all know that I talk so much about these states. And they shouldn't be that difficult to achieve if one follows the instructions. Like most other methods, ways, paths, that people don't achieve the end of that path because they linger or they miss the path, they don't follow the instructions. So please listen to the instructions carefully and see just how you can apply them. Sometimes we think we understand the instructions, but there's part of it we fail to see. It's only later on, after we achieve something or get to one of these great attainments, we see actually what we were doing wrong all those years. We realize those teachings, those instructions were actually perfect, but we misunderstood them or misapplied them. And so these are the ways of the jhanas. First of all, it needs to be mentioned, these are stages of letting go. They're not stages of attachment. They're called vimokas in the Pali, which means like freedoms, liberations. And that should give one a good idea that you don't get into freedom by clinging on to things, by attaching to things, by tying yourself to things. You only get into freedom by letting go, relinquishing, abandoning, putting down, allowing things to cease. Saying the word allowing things to cease is very important, because you can't make things cease. You have to allow them to stop, because that's the nature of the whole of samsara. And all the things in samsara, their nature is to cease. But we keep them going through craving, through control, through desire, through manipulation, through all that forcing of the mind. And where we understand sort of the Dhamma, it's very easy to let go. And we need to let go in order to see the Dhamma, to understand the Dhamma. It's almost like a catch-22 situation. Once you see the Dhamma, it's easy to let go. But you can only let go once you see the Dhamma. And, let's start that one again. That the catch-22 situation, the only way you can see the Dhamma is through letting go. And the only way you can let go is through seeing the Dhamma. So it's actually which one you start from. You have to let go a little bit, see a little bit, let go a little bit, see a little bit, let go a little bit, see a little bit. And that's the way you go into these deep meditations. But usually when I start talking about the jhanas, I start talking about the stage of the beautiful breath first. Because that's an important stage to reach, and it's like a springboard into the deeper states of meditation. And many people miss the point by not developing that happiness and bliss in their meditation. And not finding the ways to encourage this really feeling of deep sense of satisfaction, happiness, bliss, joy when we're doing our meditation. And because they fail to reach that stage, then they can get into states of peacefulness but take it no further. They never have the power to get into the deep states of meditation and see all the great things which happen from there. And I like very often to tie my teachings to the suttas to show this is not just Ajahn Brahm's ideas, that this is actually got a very, very strong foundation in the word of the Buddha. And I always like to compare this path into jhanas with the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the Buddha's great teaching on the mindfulness of the breath. For those of you who can recollect that sutta, it starts off by a person going to a quiet place, a remote place, and they're sitting down and establishing mindfulness, first of all. And in the type of meditation which we teach here, the establishing of mindfulness, I teach as present moment awareness and silence. Because that's the only way you can really establish mindfulness. When you're thinking of the past and the future, there's no real mindfulness. You're not really there. You're somewhere else. And I think you should have experienced by now that when you spread your mind over time, it has no power, no strength. You're not really seeing clearly. The whole of the attention is just dulled by being spread over too many moments of time. But if you focus it in one point of time, this present moment, then mindfulness starts to be very strong. You understand what mindfulness truly is. And when you're thinking Again, you're not fully alert, you're not fully aware, you're not fully listening. And this is why that people can't learn even what's being taught, because they're not fully listening to the words. That's why you can listen to discourse after discourse after discourse, still not understand what's being said. Because instead of listening to the words of the teacher, you're listening to the commentary inside your head. So to be able to be really mindful needs silence as well as present moment awareness. And if you can develop a lot of present moment awareness and silence, then you can say you're mindful. And having established mindfulness, then the meditator just knows the in-breath, the out-breath, going long, going short. Doesn't mean that you have to do the long breath first and then the short breath, or you make the breath natural and you know the breath. It's the first means of just knowing whether the breath is going in or going out, by making it interesting with noting the length of the breath. By noting, I mean you don't give it words. You know if it's long, you know if it's short. You don't need to say anything to know. Knowing is silent. Descriptions have words. And so we just know the breath, and then we go to the third stage of Anapanasati. I'm running through this quickly because I want to really get into the higher stages of Anapana. The third stage is knowing the full breath, the complete breath, which is from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of each in-breath, the very beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath. This is filling the mind with the breath. So there's no gaps, instead of just in, out, in, out, in, out. It's a whole process of breath. And the fourth stage is calming that breath down. And as you calm the whole thing down, you get to this very subtle breath, very peaceful. And the fifth stage is where I like to start, because then they say, from that very calm and peaceful breath, then the meditator breathes in, breathes out, developing piti and developing sukha, the fifth and sixth stages, which always need to be emphasized. You breathe in and out, developing happiness, developing joy in your meditation. Some of you have experienced this spontaneously. It's good to find out what you were doing, which actually gave rise to this happiness and joy. How do you actually create this joy without controlling? Because if you try and control and make, you find the joy disappears. And you find that so often that the joy comes as a natural result of putting energy into that mindfulness and taking it away from the doer. The trick to this is making that realization, that insight, that happiness, joy is energy. And if you can imagine just how much energy we waste in talking, in thinking, in complaining, then that energy which is wasted in those fruitless tasks of the mind, in striving, in feeling upset that it's not going right, that's all wasting energy. And it means that it takes a while for you to get your happiness and joy up again, because you've had all that lovely energy and you just poured it away down the drain holes of negativity. So, in order to stop that energy going down, we've got to put the plugs in the drain holes of negativity. Stop them up. Get into that negativity, that controlling, that thinking. And so often in my meditation, as in everyone's meditation, you think you're getting nowhere. You think you can't meditate. The mind's all over the place. And you can't get still for your life. And then you just stop complaining. Allow it to be. Really allow it to be. And it just gets silent and blissful, straight in one moment. I think I mentioned to many of you an important story in my monastic life when I had a bad toothache. Tried everything to get rid of that toothache. Nothing would work, and I was going crazy. I couldn't stand it any longer. And then, it was one of the first times I let go. I remember those words which I'd heard from my teachers, I'd read in my books. As you've heard that word, I don't know how many times in this retreat so far. 100, 200 times that word. As I'd heard that word many times, but never understood it, because I never practiced it. And when I was just so frustrated, my back was against the wall, I had nowhere to go, then that's when you let go. Ajahn Chah used to put it very, very beautifully. He said, you can't go forward, you can't go back, you can't stand still. Ah! What am I going to do? Have you ever been in that stage? Complete utter frustration, you can't do anything, you can't go anywhere, but you can't be where you are. It's just too painful. It's a terrible situation to be in. Some people think that's just the best place to be in the whole world. The reason is because you've got no choice. You have to let go. And that's the first time I let go. It's the experience which happens and happens again and again and again. You're all over the place. You're in pain. You're frustrated. You're desperate. And then you let go. And all that pain, that difficulty, just completely disappears. And you go to bliss. And the first time it happens, you think, what the heck's going on? One moment you're in pain, desperate, restless, got no happiness at all. The next moment you've got all the happiness and bliss you could ever want. Because you've really pushed the letting go button. Now when you do the breath, the more you let go, the less you control, the more you give freedom to the mind, the more you don't go with desires, but you undercut and turn off desires. You become free from desires. Remember, not freedom of desires, so let the desires go all over the place. Sometimes when people let go, they say, oh, I just let go and the mind just goes all over the place. It thinks about this and thinks about that. You're freeing, you're going for the freedom of desires. That's not letting go. You press the wrong button, you haven't understood what letting go is yet. If you press the right button, the real letting go button, not the fake one, then all the desires stop. Because it becomes freedom from desires. When it's freedom from desires, there's nothing to push the mind around. It goes very still, because its nature is to cease. Now in this meditation retreat, I've spent a lot of effort and time sort of trying to encourage pressing this letting go button. Even though that sometimes you think you're getting nowhere. Sometimes you think you're throwing away everything you've ever gained so far in meditation. Sometimes you think, well, at least if I got up 4 o'clock every morning during this retreat, I think I'd achieve something. And I've tried to encourage you to stop that attitude, to really let go, to free yourself. Because by doing that in your daily life, in what happens outside of meditation, there might be a chance that when you're watching the breath, you also have the same attitude of just letting go. Going against the stream of trying to get jhanas, trying to go against the stream of controlling everything, going against the stream of being the complainer, going against the stream of having ill will. It's amazing just how much we have ill will to things. This moment comes from its causes, it's completely conditioned causes, no one is to blame. You think, I want to blame somebody, it's the teacher, it's the monastery, it's the retreat centre, it's the beans we had this morning. It's you're going to find out about the four worldly winds today. So please make sure just that you're not you're not moved by the four worldly winds. It's not the beans, that's not the problem. That's gone, that's past, that has beans. Now is where there can be a problem. So if you let really go and just abandon, you get happiness. And this is actually shows you where the happiness comes in this meditation. Having got a meditation object, then you create this beautiful happiness with it. You calm it down, you allow it to be, you don't want to go anywhere else. For you that's a complete culmination and end of whatever you think, just being with the breath. That's all you ever wanted, that's all you ever need. You just be there, this is good enough. Then the breath becomes very beautiful. If you try and make it beautiful, if you try and polish it up, it doesn't work. If you try and do anything, it's just the same old breath. And after a while, what happens is you wander off or you fall asleep. You can't keep the breath very long in your mind. Why? Because it's not satisfying the mind. It's not enjoyable, it's not fun. And that's the main reason why people don't get any further in meditation. They don't get that happiness up quick enough. Once that happiness starts to come up, just through letting go, through relaxing, allowing it to be. Hopefully that this meditation retreat has been happy, because it's been a very easy one. You haven't forced yourself to do very much. You see how letting go gives you that happiness, freedom, peace, stillness. As you do that with the breath, then you find the breath becomes very, very beautiful and happy. I call it the beautiful breath simply because it's something I find is so delightful to look at. It's like a beautiful flower. You can just keep your eyes and attention on it for just such a long time. It's so satisfying. It never dulls you, never disturbs you. Just watch this beautiful breath. And sometimes you think you watch this beautiful breath all day. And you don't need anything else. No lunch, no dinner. You don't need to be disturbed. You don't get bored. It's this beautiful breath satisfies you. It's the happiness which is coming along with it. When the beautiful breath starts to occur, you understand that this is a stage of letting go. Not a stage of attachment. It's wrong really to call it an attainment, something you've got. Because really it's something you've had already, but you let go of all the things which occlude it, which cover it up. So you just let go, and there is a beautiful breath right in the middle. And then you just allow the beautiful breath to be. What's happening here is that the breath is the last part of your body which you're aware of. It's the last part of the five physical senses. Remember those five senses in Buddhism? Sight, hearing, smell, taste and touch. By this time when you're on the beautiful breath, you just watch the breath that fills your whole mind. There's nothing else which you're aware of. By this time already, sort of hearing is just almost gone. If you do hear anything, it's just way off in the distance, like 100 miles away. Even though it's something very loud, it seems to be such a great distance away. And you can't feel your body, it's completely gone. One of the reasons I ask people to try and disembody the breath as soon as possible, by which I mean don't put it on any part of the body. Just know the breath, but don't really pay too much attention on where on the body you know the breath. If you pay too much attention to focusing on the tip of the nose, on the belly or somewhere else, you keep the body awareness strong because of interest, because of attention, far too long. The sooner you can go just the feeling of the breath and not care where it is, the sooner the body will disappear. When you pay attention to the body, it will always be there for you. If you take attention away, it just disappears and goes and gives you freedom from all the busyness of the body. So by the time you get to the beautiful breath, the body's disappeared. You don't know if you've got aches in your back or in your legs. By this time you won't even know whether the mosquitoes are biting you or not. You won't feel them because you turned off the sense of physical touch, except for one last remnant of physical touch, being the breath. It's a strange thing, by this time, when you get to the beautiful breath, it's very hard to know whether it's actually the physical sense knowing the breath, or whether it's the mind knowing the breath. Because the physical sense is almost turned off, and you start to know the breath, not through its touch in the body, but through the mind sense, the sixth sense. You're knowing the breath much more than feeling the breath. There's a difference there, which only experience and all of mindfulness will be able to tell you what that difference is between feeling the breath and knowing the breath. Because the feelings start to get less and less and less and less, more and more subtle, because it doesn't move. Whatever doesn't move eventually disappears from consciousness. The nature of our consciousness is only to know change. Anything which is there for long periods of time, it's not interesting anymore to consciousness, and it just disappears from your perception. That's exactly what happens to the breath. If you keep it still long enough so it doesn't move, there's just breath happening. At this stage it's usually you don't know what's going in or going out, because that perception has disappeared. You don't know it's beginning or end. That's gone. All you know is just breath, feeling of breath, constant. Every moment seemingly the same, beautiful, joyful, having a good time. No effort, because the breath is holding you. It's not as if you're absorbing into the breath, it's the breath is capturing you. It doesn't come from you, it comes from the breath. That pulls you in. You don't apply yourself. All that applying, all that doing, controlling, is not necessary anymore. That's why you let go. And then the breath disappears. When the breath disappears, if you haven't built up enough happiness and joy, you'll find you just go into a peaceful state, but very blank. It's quite nice, you can stay there for quite a long time, but you can't go deeper. You haven't got enough energy to get into the jhanas. And many people actually can mistake that state of stillness and peace when a breath disappears as a jhana, but it isn't. You're not really completely removed from the physical body or from sounds. You can be disturbed reasonably easily. You can reject that sound and go back into that peace, but it's not strong enough to really go to so deep into the mind that you can never hear anything for hours on end. So you need that peace and that beauty and happiness, just as it says in the fifth and sixth stages of the Anapanasati Sutta. After the beautiful feelings of piti sukha come up, it's fascinating that the next stage is that to experience them all fully, having developed them, to experience them, and then to calm them down. To calm them down until the ninth stage is experiencing the citta. That is always known as the nimitta which comes up at this time. Because once the breath disappears, if you have enough energy, enough piti sukha, beautiful breath before, that when the breath disappears, a beautiful light appears in your mind. Again, I've mentioned before that it's possible to actually to get into jhanas through a nimitta of feeling. However, it's very, very uncertain, and it's not the best of vehicles to use. Those nimittas, we call them lights simply because that's how perception usually interprets them. The retina is not active, the eyes aren't open, you're not seeing this for your physical eye. This is a mental object which has been interpreted as a light. The important things in with nimittas are their beauty, strength and stability. Very often people see nimittas which flash up and disappear again. Or they can see many diverse nimittas all over the place. The ones which flash up and go away again you call yo-yo nimittas. They just come for a second and they disappear. The ones which flash all over the place I like to call firework nimittas. They're just all over the place. They can be fun when you first get into nimittas. Don't reject those. You got so far, enjoy. Don't get into negativity, that's a good sign. Encourage yourself, praise yourself, give yourself rewards. However, they're useless. Because they won't take you any further. Remember that the stability of that nimitta shows just how peaceful your mind is. If it moves, it means that you're moving, you're controlling, you're doing. This doing business is extremely subtle. Sometimes people think they're not doing anything, they think they're not controlling. You are. You can't see it. Your mindfulness, your wisdom is not strong enough to see that you're not really letting go. That's why you don't get into jhanas. The wisdom is not strong enough to see you're attaching. You can't see what you're actually attaching onto, but you are. If you weren't attaching, you'd get into the jhanas, you'd be enlightened. You can't see that you're craving. Why? Because you're so used to that craving, you can't notice it anymore. It's just normal, it's average. That's why we can't recognize it, but you are. If you gave up craving, if you gave up attachment, if you gave up doing, the jhanas would be just so easy for you. Enlightenment would be just there for the taking. It's the attachments, the craving, the doing stops us. So if you can't go deep and get those nimittas, you are doing something. You are craving, you're attaching. Find out what that is. Don't blame the meditation technique. Don't blame the teacher. Don't blame the Buddha or the Dhamma. That's just passing the buck. Blame attachment, craving. Blame delusion. You can't see what's actually happening. And when you blame delusion, you know that that's where the problem needs to be solved. Have more experience. Meditate more and more, get as deep as you can, and when you get to those stages where you can go no further, investigate. Investigate not by thinking, but by contemplating, getting to know that space, just like the gong bong which I held up some time ago. Keep allowing that to be long enough you really understand, you can penetrate into what's going on. Lights will go on, pennies will drop, you think, ah, yeah, you'll see what you're holding on to. When nimittas came up for me some the first time, they were always moving around. couldn't think what was going on. So I try to hold those nimittas still with my will. You get a beautiful nimitta coming up and try to grab onto it and hold it still, as if you're like a holding a person absolutely still with your strong arms. But it would never stay still. Even if I did it with subtlety, so it didn't disappear, it stayed there, but it would always be moving still. And this is, you investigate. And what I investigated, what I see, which I'm sharing with you now, is that realize the insight came up that that nimitta, that beautiful light, was a reflection of my mind. And the reason why that nimitta was moving was because I was moving. And the simile came up, it's like looking at your face in a mirror, in a bathroom. And that face is moving around, left to right, because you're moving. And you try and keep that image still by grabbing onto the mirror and holding the mirror still. And that was a very accurate simile to what you do in nimitta meditation when you try and hold that nimitta still. You're holding the mirror still. The knower, the onlooker, the mind, that is still moving. So you can hold the mirror still for as long as you like, but if the one looking is always moving, the image will not be still. You don't need to hold the mirror still to get the image motionless. You have to put a little bit of attention and recognize the knower and allow the knower to be still. This mind. When the mind is still, even if the mirror is moving, the image remains still within it. And that's how you get the nimitta to be absolutely still. It comes, it stays, and doesn't go. When nimittas do come, sometimes they're very, very beautiful. They're very, very powerful. They're sort of otherworldly. I've already mentioned that sort of other traditions, they can take this as God coming up. That's how powerful they are. And how fearsome. Because we're just naturally afraid of great power. Some reason is because it challenges us, our ego. We think we're not up to this. The less you have a sense of self, the easier it is not to be afraid. That's why a little bit of reflection on non-self, understanding it, deepening your realization of non-self little by little, not completely yet, but at least mostly, will mean that fear won't come up. Because you realize you have nothing to lose. When you think you have something to lose, the more you have to lose, the more you have to fear. So when this comes up, if fear comes, then check out your understanding of non-self. Not at that time, you have to go back, reflect, read up, discuss, listen to talks on non-self. And then you'll find that that's a great antidote to the fear which comes up in the deep meditation. Again, you can't get into these jhanas without enough wisdom. They're not for people who are stupid, who have not too much understanding about the nature of the world. You have to have at least some understanding of non-self. If you're a controller, you never get into jhanas. If you believe in sort of a big ego, you never get into jhanas. Something will come up which will be just too tough for you to pass through, and that's that fear. The other thing which often comes up, of course, is excitement, which is just as common. Maybe actually fear is more common than excitement. But sometimes you know what it's like, you've been meditating all week, and then suddenly a nimitta comes up, at last! And what happens, those of you who had that experience, wow, this is, it's gone. Even if before you can finish saying wow, it disappears. And that's so disappointing. After all the advice which I've given you, you haven't been listening and you've blown it. Please remember never to say wow in meditation. Never to get excited. Never think, wow, this is it. And get excited, because these are all stages of letting go. The ego, the self, has quieted itself down, you're allowing for things to go. And then when things start to happen, you start to get the paycheck, you send it back to the sender, return to sender. Oh, just what a fool I was. Had that beautiful opportunity, and I blew it by getting excited, by grabbing onto it, attaching onto it. It's me, it's mine, I've got somewhere at last. I have got jhanas. This is the problem. So let go of these things and be very, very still. This simile, which I always repeat at this stage, which is so useful, Ajahn Chah's simile of the still forest pool. The reason why it's useful is because all the words you can say are never as good as a picture which you can draw in your mind. That picture tells you so much more of what you're supposed to do and why. The still forest pool, Ajahn Chah in the evening sitting by the lake, eyes open, absolutely still, watching the animals come out to play. The animals would never come out if they knew someone was there looking at them, because the animals were very afraid of human beings. Most human beings were hunters. They go out there to kill those animals. That's why the animals would sniff, would sense, would look around, and if they saw there was a human being there, or sense or smell them, they would never come out. You need to be even that still, so your metabolism goes down, so you don't smell so much. Become that invisible to the animals. And Ajahn Chah was obviously a great meditator. Sometimes he was that still, which meant that being that still, animals would not know he was around. So he could just sit there and just watch these animals come out to play. Imagine what happened if you got excited and say, "Wow, there's a tiger." That tiger would know immediately and would run away. That's why you have to be so still in this meditation. If a nimitta comes up, you've got to be still like a person sitting by a forest pool, just watching but not moving. Understanding as if that nimitta will know you're watching. If you move the slightest, if you get excited or get afraid, it will just run away. And once it runs away, it doesn't come out again for many, many nights. Because even the next night it thinks that person may be there. The next night they may still be there. They may still be there. That's why if you blow a nimitta, it takes a long time to get it back again. So remember that still false pool simile. When one comes out, be like the monk, watching the animals come out to play. Not even moving an eyelid. Not even under your breath saying, "Wow." Keeping absolutely still. Then there's an image to one who's watching. The one on this side of the mirror is absolutely still, and that's why the nimitta is still. You need to be able to sustain your attention on it that way. And you find when you play with nimittas like that, it's exactly the same with the breath. You can look at the breath as one of these animals in the jungle. If you play around with it and try and control it, sometimes it just runs away. You have to be that still, and then the breath is still. If you move, the breath moves. This is how you gain that stillness. With that nimitta becoming very, very, very still, it usually brightens up by itself. They call that in the Anapanasati Samadhan Chittang, which is like sustaining that nimitta, that image of the mind. And the other thing which one has to do is to brighten up that nimitta. Because even when it's still, sometimes it's not enough to take you into jhana. It's not beautiful enough to really suck you in. The mind, which has been doing, as I said before, a lot of beautiful good things, which has been practicing virtue very strongly. I don't mean just externally, internally. Keeping the internal 8 precepts. The external 8 precepts is not killing, not stealing, etc. The internal one is not even thinking of killing, not thinking of stealing, not even thinking of sex, not even thinking of lying, not even thinking of indulging in drugs, not even thinking of eating in the afternoon. Do you think about eating in the afternoon? Not even thinking about playing and fantasizing and dreaming, just like watching the inner movies. Not even thinking of indulging. It's the inner precepts. Are very strong. So the mind is very, very pure. So pure that when you see its reflection as a nimitta, it's so brilliant and bright. If you have virtue, you don't need to do much polishing up of nimittas. They're already just so perfect, so powerful and so beautiful. However, if you're the ordinary Joe, then sometimes you have to do a bit of polishing, because sometimes our conduct is not perfect. Sometimes we have followed our defilements, that we have been stingy and greedy. We've been too attached to our possessions, to our money. We've been just too indulgent, and sort of sometimes taking the easy course of not being absolutely honest with our business dealings or with our tax forms. Sometimes we've even lied. Sometimes we've said bad things to somebody else. Hurtful things, bad speech. We haven't said it, we've thought it. All these little things which we've done in our life means, you know what I mean, because they're not pure. You know at the time that this is just coming from a self, coming from an ego, coming from ill will, coming from greed, stinginess, selfishness, all these defilements of the mind. And when we act like that, our mind becomes dirtied. It loses its shine. It loses its brilliance. You know, that sort of like holy people are supposed to have these auras. You understand what those auras are? It's just the shining of the jitta. It gets so bright, so pure, so wonderful, that even it seems that the glow of the chitta is even seen with the human eyes, as a glow around a person. This is a pure person. You don't see those glows around heedless people, impure people. So as our mind gets brighter and brighter through the practice of sila, virtue, restraint, goodness, generosity, all these paramitas, these spiritual qualities which are also supposed to be building up, not just for the sake of going to heaven, but for the sake of requisites for enlightenment, requisites for samadhi, jhana. When these come up, the nimittas are so wonderful and so beautiful, the most beautiful thing you could ever imagine, more beautiful than you can imagine. The nimitta is shined up so much, it's beautiful. If that nimitta is not shined up enough, there is these little tricks which, you know, we give you on the way. Look in the centre of the nimitta, because that's where the beautiful part always is. Don't look on the edges, because on the edges is duality. There's too much business. This is singleness of mind, simplicity of mind. You only find that in the middle, not in the edges. It's as if in the middle it glows the most. And if you can gain this attitude of meditation, always going into the centre of things, the middle of things. Even the middle of a flower, the inner petals of a flower, always the most delicate and beautiful. Have a look outside. When you go into the middle of the nimitta, it's the most beautiful and delicious path. And even though the outer parts of the nimitta may be a bit grey and grubby, nearly always the inner part is the most wonderful. Almost like the Mahayana teaching, the Buddha nature, right in the centre of you. Even the most impure people have this pure heart. Maybe that's what that means, because that's what you see. And if you can go into that middle part of a nimitta, very, very gently, because you can't move too much, you'll just disturb the whole thing, then that nimitta becomes brilliant. Brighter than a million suns, and more beautiful than any light you've ever seen. That captivates one. And as a result of that, one has the experience of either sinking in, being enveloped by, enclosed by, this beautiful bliss. And this is what we call the jhana experiences. Very often, the first time this happens, one sinks in and comes right out again. Again, it's like not a yo-yo nimitta, but a yo-yo jhana. It's very, very common at first that this happens. You go into the most bliss you've ever experienced in your life, and you come straight out again. The reason is because you didn't have that stillness. The last moment, again, you're excited. You moved, so the jhana couldn't last. Only lasted a fraction. But if you just get that much, that will just change your whole life. Just the way, the power of the whole thing. It'll show you that there's something which is so amazing, so profound, so deep, so blissful. You'll never be able to forget it, you'll never be able to put it aside. You'll have to find ways of getting back there. You'll have to learn how to detach once again. Maybe you detach just by chance, by luck. But then you have to go through the hard work. It's almost as if the advert has been seen, and now you have to go and work to buy the goods. We have to find a way to detach, to let go, to relinquish, to be virtuous, to be good, for the sake of the most wonderful experience of your life. It's like seeing the most beautiful woman, only just incredibly beautiful. You fall in love straight away, you just have to have her. The most amazing man, using worldly metaphors. You become bewitched, entranced, intoxicated. You have to get that. You can't put it aside, you can't forget. And eventually you learn just how to keep that calm, that same degree of stillness and letting go, no control, no excitement, no fear. So the next time that happens, when you feel as if the awareness, the knowing is being drawn into this beautiful nimitta, that you allow it to happen, and you get this amazing unity of consciousness, the knower and the known in exactly the same place. So the nimitta, the reflection of the mind, the reflection is right in the mind, the mind is in the reflection, right in one place. You can imagine what that can be like, that ekagata, that unity of mind, that one peakedness of mind. Some people call it one pointedness, as was pointed out to me some time ago, but that's not an accurate rendition of the Pali. It's one peak of mind. Agga is a peak, a high peak, a summit. It's the mind has come to a summit, like the tip of a mountain. Not an ordinary point, but a very lofty, high point. Everything has come to one point in time and in space. And there are some consequences of ekagata. One of those consequences is you just have not got the space to know, to think, or to contemplate. Thinking actually is long since gone. Any person who says that you can think within a jhana has not experienced the jhanas at all. Anyone who's experienced those jhanas knows that thinking is far too coarse and cannot exist in those jhanas. It's absolutely crazy to think so. There's no thinking in the jhanas. The mind is too still for that, far too still. But interesting, there's no way to contemplate, simply because it's as if you're too close to your nose. You're just too close to these things. You can't move. If you want to contemplate things, it's interesting. You have to move to contemplate it. See it this way, see it that way, see it the other way. When it's absolutely still, you know. But you can't work out what you're knowing. It's just knowing. Very still, frozen. So it's actually only afterwards, when you emerge from a jhana, that you can know what that was. Which means if you're in the state of deep bliss and meditation, if you can ask the question, what is this? It can never be a jhana. The very fact that you can ask that question should tell you this can't be a jhana. In real jhanas, you can't ask that question. In real jhanas, the mind is frozen. Contemplation becomes impossible. It is a very different state of consciousness. But only afterwards, because these states of consciousness are so strong, so blissful, so powerful, they leave a very, very strong imprint in you. So it's very easy to reflect upon them afterwards. You see, if you have the jhana, it's too close to you during the experience, but afterwards, it's like memory, you put it out here. And then you can move it around after a while. What exactly was that? What was going on there? And this is where you reflect and you know what that jhana is. You know what particular jhana it is. And you know what its meaning is to you in the realm of insight. First of all, you look at that, and you can actually see if it's called a first jhana, is what I call the wobble. This is only an experiential word. You never find this word wobble in the Pali, but you do find the words vitakka vichara, which theorists, experts on Pali, but not experts on meditation, sometimes call initial and applied thought. And when you see that, I think, oh, come on, you guys, don't just translate, don't just read these things, practice it, and you see for yourself what a stupid translation that is. No way in the world is it applied or sustained thought. Thinking is long since gone. Well, you find out the reason why there's a wobble there is because there is, even though I said the dual is gone, there's still a remnant of activity. And that remnant of activity is just a little bit of grasping. That where grasping is the mind, even though it's in unity, it hasn't got enough confidence yet to absolutely let go. It's almost 99.79% let go, and it's holding on. Because of that holding on to that nimitta, to that experience, to that bliss. Sometimes people ask me, first of all, do you see the nimittas in jhanas? No, you're in the nimitta. You can't see it. You are it. It's a different experience. If you ask what's happening there, you're just blissed out. That's the object of the jhana. Not a nimitta, not a light, just absolute bliss. That bliss, almost like it's pulsating in the first jhana. I mean, very softly, just a wobble. The reason is because you're holding on, it disturbs everything. As if the mind moves off. The experience starts to fade a little bit, but it's so strong, you're so still, you just go straight back in. Almost immediately. And then you're still holding on. So there's a little bit of a wobble there in the experience. Sometimes the only way you know this is by getting into second jhana, knowing what I mean by the wobble, because the wobble is gone. So often, as I said, the only way you know what water is when you leave water. And you actually got some perspective on it, some overview. The only way you can know what a jungle is actually to get out of the jungle, go above and beyond it and look down upon it. Then you know, oh, that's what the jungle is. Usually, the only way you can really know what second jhana is, first jhana is by getting into a second jhana. Then you've got the perspective to understand what the wobble is and what the wobble isn't. Because in the second jhana, just that holding on completely disappears. You've got what's called, it's a very beautiful word which you read in the Pali, ajatang sampasadanang, which is like internal confidence or internal joy. Joy and confidence are the same words in Pali, pasanna, pasada. And this is where you have the full absolute letting go called samadhi. But in that, back to the first jhana, you have the little bit of a wobble there, you have that oneness of mind. Sometimes people talk about non-duality. It's become like a key word in some traditions. And sometimes it becomes just like a philosophical word. And people like argue about it, and they have these debates about non-duality. But it's nothing like the experience of non-duality. When you ask what non-duality is, and you go through the record of all your experiences, what is non-duality? That's the first experience of non-duality you'll ever have in jhanas. There's not two, there's one peakiness of mind. When there's only oneness, you cannot contemplate, you can't move. This is one of the fascinating parts of non-duality of consciousness. There's no movement possible. To have movement, you need space, you need two. You can't know. It's interesting, the word for consciousness in Pali is vijnana. Vij is the same root as bi, like bifocals. Binary means two. Vijnana means like two knowing. Jnana, like jnana dhamma, knowing, wisdom. It's like the discriminating knowing. Knowing by its opposites. You know dark by light. You know happiness through pain. In this knowing, there is no two at all. There's only oneness. That's why it's weird and strange. The main object of these first jhana is the bliss, the piti sukha. So if you ask anyone who's been in jhana, if you ask yourself one of those experiences, what were you watching? What was actually the experience? What was happening there? You just say you're experiencing bliss. Biggest bliss you've ever experienced in your life. Way beyond orgasm, way beyond nimittas. Absolute, unmoving, unified bliss. Seemingly powerful, but there's no fear, of course, because fear needs duality, needs space. And the amazing thing is it lasts for a long period of time. Obviously, while you're in this state, you don't know time at all. There's perfect one-pointedness in time as well. Present moment is really strong. Not that you know you're in the present moment, but you just are. So you don't know time passing. That's why you get into these states and open your eyes afterwards. It could be 2 hours, 3 hours, 10 hours. There's no way of knowing what time has gone. Because you go into timelessness. So all these places, things are very mystical and very great fun. And because of the power of those states, when you come out, the body is never stiff or aching. There's no pain, even though you can only ever meditate it for 20 minutes before. If you get into a jhana and meditate for 20 hours, you won't have any pain or difficulty at all. Your body will just so light, skipping along. This is actually what happens in that one pointedness. The mind is so strong, the body is energized, healed, empowered, all sorts of things. What you're experiencing is bliss. Sometimes it takes a while, because afterwards you come out afterwards and you contemplate what exactly was that bliss. Sometimes the different jhanas have different types of bliss. You will do contemplate to know what jhana is and to know exactly what that bliss is and why it was bliss. That's why the first jhana is the bliss born of letting go of the body and the five senses. And that is a powerful reason for insight. You see that why it's so blissful is because you've got rid of this body and these five senses. Why do we want to see? Why do we want to hear? Why do we want to feel? Why do we want to live in this world? Because we really think this is happiness, or happiness can be found here. When you see just how much suffering it is to see the most beautiful flower, to see how much suffering it is to hear Bach played by a good orchestra, you see how much suffering it is to have the best sex in your life, and you see how much dukkha that is, because you've got something which is so much superior. You realize that even the best, the very peak of five sense experiences, you see without a shadow of doubt from that perspective, is dukkha. Suffering, real suffering, burning, pain. But because that's the least pain you've known so far, you take that as happiness. Seeing a beautiful sunset may be the least pain you've ever experienced. Having sex may be the least pain you've known in your body. Listening to Bach may be the least pain you've had through your ears. So you take that to be happiness, because that's the best you've known. If you go deeper into a jhana, you realize there's so much more than that, and that this actually was pain, this was suffering. When you start to see this, you start to understand the Four Noble Truths, why the Buddha started his teaching with the truth of suffering, and why hardly anybody understands that. They haven't had the experience yet, they haven't had the data, they don't know. Once you experience these things, you see the bliss of the jhanas, the world outside will sort of lose all its luster. The more you experience those jhanas, the bliss born, even the first jhana, the bliss born of letting go of the body and the five senses, your attachment to that world, your hope that that world will give you anything meaningful and worthwhile, your craving for those things will be weakened and weakened and weakened, until with enough experience of those jhanas you'll have no craving for the world of the body and the five senses ever again. You'll be an anagami, a non-eternal. You've cut off the attachment to that world through insight, through experience, which is seeing that what once you thought was pleasure was actually suffering. It was the fraud of the five senses. Just like in one of the suttas, it says, like a man who was blind was sold a white cloth, told it was the finest white cloth in the whole of India, and he bought it at great expense, put it around him, thinking just what a great fellow he was to have the most expensive beautiful cloth in the whole of India. Sometime later a doctor managed to restore his sight, and he saw this was just an old rag, dirty and black. Because he was blind before, he didn't know, and he said he'd get very upset that this guy had sold him sort of an old dirty rag, saying it was beautiful and white. In the same way, when we get into jhanas and we see insight, sometimes we can feel a bit disappointed that we've been sold this dirty old rag of the body and the five senses, thinking it's wonderful and beautiful and lovely. This is what happens. We get nibbida, we turn away from that world as a natural course. That's how attachment is broken. Not through thinking, not through contemplating, through experience. Second jhana, you might just go straight into a second jhana, past the first. That's when the mind lets go so much that it's that bliss born of samadhi, of absolute stillness. You never realize things or the world, the universe could be so still. Rock-like stillness, like a diamond not even any movement at all. That's a fascinating thing, just to be, but being unable to contemplate, being unable to know in the usual way. Bliss which doesn't change an iota for hours and hours and hours. Absolutely still. That degree of stillness, again, is beyond the comprehension of this world. But when you get into these states, when you come out afterwards and reflect, that's called samadhi. This is a bliss born of samadhi. Samadhi ja piti sukha. Born of that confidence which finally lets go, completely abandons. And that is also hugely powerful and blows the mind away. You realize what movement is, activity, and how all this craving business just makes you move away from the stillness, from the non-doing, from the non-duality, just from the sense of oneness and stillness and peace, which is the nature of this universe when you get out of the way. You go even deeper. You can even let go of even parts of the consciousness, which is happiness, or rather joy and bliss. The third jhana is of a different type of bliss. Something has fallen away. It's part of consciousness, part of knowing. As you go deeper into the jhanas, from here on in, you're letting go of more and more. Not of doing. Doing completely ends for the second jhana. Third, fourth jhana to the immaterial attainments. You're letting go of the knower, of the mind. Till the end when you get into the last of the attainments, which is complete cessation. The one before, neither perception nor non-perception. Almost gone. Can't really say whether you're conscious or you're not conscious. Then it's gone. Cessation of the knower. The jitta, the mind, everything has completely ceased. This is the ultimate in letting go. You can't let go more than that. This is only temporary letting go. But afterwards, when you come out afterwards, those experiences are so strong, you cannot help but contemplate them afterwards. When you contemplate that experience, immediately, you will see that the knower is not the self. The jitta is just a process. Things rise and fall. The nature of the jitta, the nature of all that is eventually to cease. Not to cease with some remainder somewhere, but to cease absolutely, completely, gone, forever gone. Because that's what its nature was in the beginning. Now that's what its nature is afterwards. Absolute emptiness, gone, finished with. Cessation. Consciousness. The last refuge of yourself disappeared. Afterwards, you're either enlightened fully or non-eternal. There's no other way. Those are the two things which have to happen, one or the other. So this is the power of those experiences. Not only do you get huge amounts of data, things which ordinary people can't know, but which the Buddha found out under the Bodhi tree. Had all that powerful data which he contemplated afterwards, and he saw what they meant. From that data of the jhanas, he saw the doer is not self, the knower is not self. These five khandhas can't be me. Don't know self at all. Saw the suffering of the world. Not just the suffering of not getting what you want, not just the suffering of physical pain, not just the suffering of somebody dying, but even the suffering of somebody living. Even the suffering of winning the lotto. Even the suffering of getting a jhana. Seeing the whole lot. And realize from there, there's everything right through to the core. The suffering could let go of all experience and put an end to all of this, the samsara. That is the way of enlightenment. That is why jhanas are so important. Even though it does say in the suttas, it does imply even that people without jhanas can become stream winners. I can't see it myself. I can't see how you can have the data. But certainly everyone does agree, the more you have jhanas, the closer you are to enlightenment. That's why they even say, not only that when you become enlightened, you're standing in the footprints, so when you gain a jhana, you're standing in the footprints of the Buddha. You're actually knowing what it's like to be a Buddha. Sometimes people go to the four places in India, the four places of worship. You know what those are? There's Lumbini, where the Buddha was born. There is Bodh Gaya, where he became enlightened. There's Sarnath, where he gave the first sermon. And there's Kusinara, where he passed away. And I say those are the places to go if you really want to find out where the Buddha hung out. If you want to know where the Buddha hung out, where he lived, you don't need to go to India. Just go deep into your mind, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's where the Aryas hang out. That's their abode. They don't live in India, they don't live in Thailand, they don't live anywhere else, they live in the jhanas. So these are the realms of the Aryas. These are the realms of the Buddha. That's why the Buddhists call that happiness Sambodhisukha. He called it the bliss of enlightenment. Strange he said that, because it's not enlightenment, but it's that close. That close. He decided to give it that high word, the enlightenment bliss. So today I've told you how to do it. I've told you some of the problems and obstacles which come up. It's all letting go, abandoning, giving up. So you can see why you should let go and give up. Get into one of these jhanas once, or even close, you understand the power of letting go, renunciation, giving up. You understand why monks and nuns are celibate. Why good monks and nuns do give up all their possessions and have few things. Not because of just the vinaya, but because this is a way to enlightenment. Not only the way, but the expression afterwards. This is why a good monk, there's just no way you can have sex. Why would you want to bother with that? Okay, I'm going to be gross here. What the Buddha said is like a person falling into a cesspool and being dragged out by the king, cleaned up, given seven baths, put on clean clothes. Would he ever jump back in that cesspool again? I think you know the simile. I'm not going to tell it because sometimes people get upset at monks saying things like this. But that's the Buddha simile. And this is actually what happens. This is what it's like. So that's the jhanas and what they mean. Any questions or comments? Is there anything called Vipassana jhana? No, there's not. You look through the whole suttas. No, actually, the suttas are CDs. Not on CDs. It's typed into the internet. What's it called?
CD-ROM,
yeah. So you can get one of these CD-ROMs of the entire Tipitaka and type in Vipassana jhanas and see how many entries or how many hits you have. And you have zero, nil, zip. That word does not exist in the Pali Canon. The Buddha never used that word. However, jhanas are all, there's only jhanas. They are based on both Vipassana and Samatha. There's no jhanas without wisdom. You have to have wisdom. Insight is part of the path of jhanas. Calm is part of the path. There's no difference. Sometimes people say Samatha jhanas and Vipassana jhanas, and I thought, oh my goodness, why don't you attain a jhana instead of trying to talk about what you don't know? Otherwise you'd never call them Samatha jhanas, you'd never call them Vipassana jhanas. They're just jhanas. That's all. Sort of, you know, it's like, you know, air. Air is just air. You know, it's not sort of like Australian air and Sri Lankan air and English air is somehow sort of different. It's all air. It's the same thing, no matter where it is. So these are just the same thing. Jhana is jhana. It has to be bliss, unmoving, unchanging. No thinking possible. For long periods of time. Sometimes I have another word which is actually missing the point, they're called Kanika Samadhi, which is like, it means like momentary sustained attention. Now think about that, momentary sustained attention, like momentary peace. So it's like what you call like an oxymoron, two words juxtaposed which have opposite meanings to each other. There's no such thing as momentary Samadhi. If it's Samadhi, it has to last for a long time. It's stillness. If it only lasts for a moment, it's not still. Yes?
Why do most meditation teachers mention the truth of the Vipassana rather than other kind of practice?
Well, they do that. I think it's just because of how they've been taught by their teachers and knowing no better. And I think it's actually, I know it should be recorded this, but anyway, I'm doing it anyway. I don't care these days. I think the original sort of so-called Satipatthana method by Mahasi Sayadaw, from little, I never met the monk myself, but other monks who did meet him, it seems to be that he could get into deep samadhis. And I think he may have been teaching this to lay people, thinking they could not get any better than just a bit of vipassana, thinking that they hadn't renounced enough to get into jhanas. So, you know, why teach lay people jhanas when they thought they can't do them? Let's teach them vipassana instead. However, I think that's second changing the lay community. Buddha never taught like that. He taught just freely to everybody. And some lay people did get those jhanas. They could renounce enough. They could let go enough to get those jhanas. Even if they couldn't, what happened afterwards, it seemed, that those teachings were taught to the monks as well, because many of the monks had no other meditation teachers at all. In places like Sri Lanka, there was no meditation being taught at all. So that was the only stuff. That's the only thing they knew. So that's why it became popular, because there was nothing else. If you go back to the original teachings of the Buddha, and especially the forest tradition in northeast Thailand, that was their teaching, that was their path to do jhanas. That's why they lived in the forest, not in the big noisy cities. Because there's a way of renouncing and a way of getting peace and solitude enough to get those jhanas. That's why, in for example, in my monastery, we don't have all these meetings every morning in the Bodhinyana monastery. We try and sort of, you know, keep it as simple as possible to give the monks as much encouragement and time as possible to get the jhanas. So my monastery in Serpentine is actually built for the purpose of attaining jhanas. That's what we do it for. So that's why sometimes we keep, not too many people can stay there. We've only got a few places where people can stay for that reason, because it was a retreat centre. It just gets too noisy. And it means that, yeah, many more people could come and stay and meditate, but fewer people would get jhanas. You need seclusion, ease, peace and stillness to do that. So that's why even our monasteries, 20 monks will be maximum, no more than that. You think, why? You've got lots of space there. Why can't you build more kutis? Say, no. It becomes more people. It just becomes more management, more problems, more difficulties. Feeding the monks will become this huge burden every day. And use ceremony. And we lose the simplicity necessary for jhana practice. You need lots and lots of time for this. Hours and hours and hours and hours sitting in your hut, going through frustration, difficulty, getting encouragement, trying again, learning, having all this amazing support, where the monks in my monastery don't have to do hardly anything. That's why there's many monks there, some are senior, why I will not send them to Singapore to teach. Because I want them to get the jhanas first of all. I think you appreciate why you do that. You get really, really good monks and nuns. Really good ones. And then send them out, and it's much better. One really good monk or nun is worth 100 sort of mediocre monks and nuns. That's what we want to do. You try?
Are you saying that when you've got ministers, and you are focusing on those ministers, then that's the moment of truth when the sila comes in? It's just like, you know, you're on the edge.
Yeah.
I've got two questions, but this is the first one. And the second one is, when the light in the head goes and it then expands, so there's no breath around it, and it's just throughout the body, and there's no body, and there's no nothing. That's all.
And then coming
out of that feeling, like there's almost been a death, but
here
you are.
Carry on, what's the question?
What's that?
Okay, the only way you can know what these things are is actually to contemplate afterwards and see whether they check all the list off, any thinking in there. Was it real bliss? I mean, real strong bliss, not just ordinary bliss, just really other world bliss. And was it a long period of time? Exactly what was going on? Was there any movement there, any stillness? You have to be very careful here, because sometimes people want jhana so much They manufacture them. They sort of, remember I was saying the other day about view and perception of thought? If you want things so much, you know, as a psychologist, you know how you can actually manufacture, go into denial, but not just denial of actually avoiding things, but actually making much more of something that's really there. This is where you've got to be very, very careful, because that's why when people have experiences, it's good they go and talk to like a monk, someone's had those experiences, and check them out. Most of the monks will be very negative and say, yeah, what do you think you are? Jhana? You know, that's not jhana, don't be stupid. It might make you upset, but it's really challenging you. And afterwards you go away, and you know, people actually say to me, oh, Ajahn Brahm was so fierce on me, and sort of, you know, he didn't think I had a jhana, but then I'd tell him right next to me, that was a jhana. But I've really got a challenge, because the delusion can be so strong you can manufacture these things.
Does will take you into that space?
No.
Like, think that you are, but you aren't.
Yeah, it is a delusion. I want jhana so much. The person sitting next to me, or those of you who've got your husband or wife into, my wife's got jhana, but not me. It's amazing just how much pride comes up, you know, with these spiritual pride when you talk about jhanas. That's the danger, that's the downside of a talk such as this. It can create so much craving for jhanas when I talk like this that sometimes it becomes counterproductive. So be warned. Remember the path in. And in the end, it doesn't really matter. You can always let go a little bit more next time. Let go a little bit more next time. Keep letting go. Even if it's a jhana, there's always second jhana coming next. If you've got second jhana, there's always third jhana. So don't be heedless. Let go a bit more.
Sila,
oh yeah, just so important, because again we can be very delusive to ourselves and we can think, oh, I'm not such a bad boy, you know, everyone else does the same, and it's just sort of, you know, it's my natural proclivities as a human being, as a man, you know, got to have lust, you know, it's just some hormones, it's not really me. And it's so easy actually to justify it in the world and to actually not be very, very strict with oneself. But then you get this nimitta coming up, and oh my God, there I am. It's as if you're seeing yourself bare, without any coverings. And as you really see then, if the nimitta's not bright, it means you'll be messing around. So look at yourself. Have you really been generous? Somebody needs something, just go and give. Your gratitude to your teachers, to your parents, to other people who've looked after you and helped you. You've got this wonderful way of like speaking to people, always giving them the benefit of the doubt, forgiving. These very beautiful parts of the mind, which when you see it happening, like great acts of forgiveness, great acts of dana. You know that one of the great acts of dana, which will always be in my mind, that young girl in Bungwai village who was born mentally deformed, so mentally deficient, couldn't speak, could only grunt, couldn't do things, would never go to school, could never get married, because, you know, she was in places like Perth or Singapore, they go to an institution, but they was just accepted into the village, just as one of them. And one day when I was cleaning the hall, I saw this girl creep in. I was behind the cupboard, so she didn't see me. I saw her. I saw her look around to make sure that no one was there, but I hid and watched her. And she took this little paper lotus flower which she'd made and put it on the shrine and bowed. That's the best you could do. But I almost cried, and I get teary whenever I think of that. And she bowed and she ran out, because she was so embarrassed, because she thought maybe that such an ordinary, even ugly thing, the best she could make, but nowhere near as good as anyone else could make, she thought that may not be able to go on the Buddha shrine. But it did. And when I saw that, I told the monks, if anyone moves that thing, you're going to be in big trouble. And that was a huge act of dana, because for her it was just so difficult to do. And that was beautiful. That's what I mean by dana, giving. Sort of forgiving someone who's really hurt you, and really been mean and nasty to you, just, I forgive you. Even though that they're wrong and you're right, I forgive you. That beauty of the mind, that's the inspiration of the spirit, that's what makes the mind brilliant and bright. Everything which inspires you in the world, which you see in others, do yourself, and then your nimitta becomes so brilliant and bright But very easy, you're just watching the beautiful breath and limiter comes up straight away. It's just too bright, it just bursts in. It just pushes you out. So when you've got lots of virtue, and I don't just mean keeping precepts, that's what you're not supposed to do, you know, breaking precepts, but what you are supposed to do. Not just the negative, the positive. And then when you do both of those, your limiter is just so wonderful. It bursts through very easily. It comes out much quicker than ordinary because it's so powerful. Okay, question from Ainsley before we finish off.
You practically answered it. I was going to ask what we need to do to improve our mental field.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's to have things like the paramitas, you know, in both Mahayana and Theravada. What is that like? Dana. This is the Mahayana ones. Dana, Kanti, Wirya, and Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Dana is generosity, Kanti is endurance, Virya is energy, and you have four extra ones in Theravada, which is Nekama, renunciation. Somebody wants your shirt, give it to them. That's renunciation. Nekama, I think Metta is one of them. Metta and Upeka, like loving kindness. Upeka, equanimity. Sorry? Karuna, no, Satya, yeah, Satya, truthfulness. And those are all these like spiritual qualities, which when we actually, you can see these really brighten up our minds, this truthfulness. Even though it hurts actually to confess what you did. So truthfulness is most important. So you just say, this is what I did, even though it means that, you know, I might be executed or killed. You see just how that's really high-minded, and that's pure, and when people do those things, amazing, just the beauty of the nimittas. Which means also when you die, that light you go to the end of the tunnel is just amazingly beautiful. That's why it can take you to a heavenly birth, if nowhere higher. So that's where the payoff for virtue comes in. It's not just keeping precepts, it's all the other things which happen also. Okay, that's jhanas, nimittas, purity, virtue, enlightenment. That's the whole works this morning. So if you don't get enlightened, it's not my fault. I've done everything possible. So now's the time for interviews. I'm about 20 minutes late. So just please forgive me.